All right, everybody, welcome to the iOS Staff's Choice walkthrough. Today we'll be going over Evil Hangman. So just a reminder, these videos will be available at cs76.net/projects. And there we already have all the slides and source code updated if you want to follow along on your own machine. So today we're going to go over just a review of the strategy for Evil Hangman, just to make sure everyone's clear on what we're supposed to actually be doing, so it's not super obvious. And then we're going to take a look at the setup code. So when you first create a new utility application, you get all this code generated for you, so we're going to step through that so you know exactly what's going on at every point. Then we're going to talk about this notion of equivalence classes and the different ways you can implement those, and maybe what design decisions might be better than others. And finally, just some tips and tricks, methods you might find useful as you're going through and implementing Evil Hangman. So this is an awesome PSET. It's very evil, in case that was not clear by the spec. So be careful as you're implementing it. So the goal for Evil Hangman is to dodge the user's guess as best as possible. So translated into code, what you're going to want to do is be able to switch among the largest number of words. So this maybe isn't the most optimal strategy because you have things like, well, the user's never heard of this obscure word, so I should go on that. But it's optimal enough. So your code should really be able to maximize the ability to cheat. So maximize the number of words that you can choose between. So let's just run through a scenario, and feel free to ask questions as I'm going through that. We have plenty of time for questions in the walkthrough. So let's just walk through some scenarios. So we have a three-letter word, and these are the 1, 2, 3, 7 seven words in our dictionary. So let's say the user guesses an N. So here are all of our different options for our equivalence classes. So first, we can say that there is no N in the word, in which case the only word we could choose from is the word LOL, because there's no N there. Next, we could say the N is the first letter, in which case there are three different words that we can choose from because those three words have an N in the first spot. We could say there's an N at the last spot, and again, we have three different words we'd be able to switch between if we fix the N at that point. And all the other possible locations of the N, there are no words in our dictionary that have letters there, so we're obviously not going to choose those. So at this point, we can actually either choose either of these. So it doesn't, according to the spec, it doesn't matter if we pick the top one or the bottom one. When you have a tie break, you can break your ties arbitrarily, pseudo-randomly, the first one, the last one, however you want to break your ties, it doesn't matter. So in this case, we're just going to pick the second one. So we're going to put the N in the last spot. So once we have an N there and we've revealed to the user that there is an N in that location, we can't go back and change it. So because we have an N there, we've effectively changed our working set of words. So we no longer need to consider LOL because we've fixed that location of the N. So we can cheat, but we can't cheat so much and say, actually, I lied to you. There's no N there. It's actually an L. So we can, there's a limit to our cheating, so keep that in mind. So now let's say the user guesses a P. So remember that these were the three words we had to work with, own, pun, and one. So if the user were to guess a P, here are our equivalence classes again. So we could say there's no P, in which case we have the option to choose between own and one. We could say there's a P at the beginning, in which case we'd have one word to choose from. And the other possible locations of the P, there are no words to choose from. So here, what's the computer going to do? Right. So it's going to pick the top one. It's going to say that there is no P, and then you're going to decrement the number of available guesses left to the user. So that's the basic strategy of our algorithm. So this is called a greedy algorithm. So at each step of our algorithm, we're going to optimize to find the solution just at that step. So we could look ahead and say, well, if the user guessed an A, they're likely to guess an E next, and we could go on this whole cool algorithm thing, but we're not. We're just going to use the greedy algorithm. We're going to pick the best possible letter choice at each step. So you don't need to consider past or in the future. Just consider at this step, and you want the best choice at this step, and that's actually going to be effectively optimal, even though it might sound like that's kind of a dumb idea. So are there any questions on the algorithm behind Evil Hangman before we get going? Cool. So do let me know if anything comes up while we're going through it. So for this app, we're going to be creating a utility application. So in section, we took a look at a navigation application, and that's going to generate a whole different set of boilerplate code than will this utility application. So what this is going to do is it's going to generate two new view controllers for us. The first is called main view, and that's going to be the first view that's presented to the user. And the second is this flip side view, which will be the view you'll be using for your settings. So a common utility application you've probably all seen is the weather app. which the front has all the weather. You click a little eye on the back, and you can change the settings for your weather. So inside of your main view controller, you have this method called showInfo. What this is going to do is it's going to create a new view controller. In this case, it's going to be the flip side view controller, since it's the only other one we have available. So in section, we looked at this push view controller onto the navigation stack. Just like we have push view controller, we also have this present modal view controller, which will similarly push a new view controller onto the stack and display it to the user. However, we're not going to have this navigation item and a back button. We're just going to present it modally. So it's just going to fill the whole screen, and there's going to be no hierarchical drill down anything taken care of for us. So we have this button at the top that's been connected in Interface Builder for us. We don't have to worry about that. And this button, although it looks like a little small eye, is actually just a UI button. Would you create that rounded rect button? You could actually create that little eye by just going to the attributes and changing its type. And so we'll take a look at how that happens. Now, inside of the flip side view controller, you have this method done. And so what this method's going to do is effectively hide the controller. So again, we have a little done button in the top left, and that's been connected via Interface Builder. And so this, again, is just a standard UI bar button item, just like that edit button on our table views. And we still have this self.navigation item, and that's going to be the menu bar at the top of the view. So even though we're not in a navigation controller anymore, we still have this navigation item. So you'll recall that on iOS, we use this design pattern called delegation a lot. What delegation says is that instead of implementing methods to do something inside of this class, so in this case, instead of implementing methods inside of flipside view controller, we're going to create a delegate object. And inside of that delegate object, we're going to define the behavior that's going to occur as a result of actions in this other view controller. So basically, instead of doing it ourselves, we're going to create an object who knows how to do it, and we're just going to say, okay, object, you handle this method. I don't feel like implementing it myself. So this is kind of like a notion of callbacks. And this is kind of how we're going to do this start activity for result, which we don't have available to us anymore because it's just not a method in iOS. But this is basically how we're going to implement that same functionality. So to how from the first view controller to get rid of the second view controller. So a lot of words, but basically we're going to define a new protocol. And this protocol says that we're going to need to implement a single method. And that's going to be flipside view controller did finish. So this method is going to be called whenever this controller should be hidden. Now, we could just implement this in flipside view controller ourselves and just hide it from there. But we instead want to delegate control to the main view controller. So that's where we're going to use this protocol inside of the main view controller. And that's where we're going to define the behavior of this method, flipside view controller. So let's take a look at what that looks like. So I'm going to create a new project. On the source code online, there's already a simple utility application created for you. It's heavily commented, so you can follow along line by line. But I'm just going to create a new utility application. I'm going to call it test. That looks good. Now look at that. I already did that. Okay. So we just created a new project, and over here, you'll see we have those two view controllers. So we have our main view controller and our flip side view controller. So before we take a look at the code, let's actually run this project just to see exactly how much code we just got for free. Okay. So we've loaded our app, and down in the bottom right corner here, you'll see this I button. Now, if we press this, that was actually kind of cool. It just did this little horizontal flippy thing. And now we're at this other view controller. Up in the top left here, I have this done button that if I click, I do the cool horizontal flippy thing back to the original view controller. So that's pretty sweet. I didn't write a single line of code, and I've already handled that cool animation. I've got this button. So that worked out pretty well. So let's take a look at our view controllers. So first, this is our main view controller, and you'll notice that it's using this protocol, this flip side view controller delegate. We're also defining this method, showInfo. Okay, so let's take a look at what showInfo is wired up to. So if we open up our nib, we click this info button, you'll see, whoa. So see here that this type is set to info light. Now if we just open this up, we can actually just make this a rounded rect button, which is what we're used to seeing. But by default, it's just nice to have that info light. So if we look at the connections, we'll see that we've wired up the touch event to the show info method. So nothing new there. It's just Xcode happened to do this for us. We just did the equivalent of dragging this over to the files owner and selecting the show info method. So we've made that connection. Xcode set it for us. We didn't have to worry about that. So we open up the implementation file, and we have a whole lot of code written for us. So here's the implementation of show info. So just like we saw in section, we have this init with nib name. And so we're creating an instance of our second view controller. So this init with nib name just tells the controller what nib it's going to use to display all of its views. So nothing new there. Now you notice that we're setting the delegate property of this controller to self. And this says that the main view controller, where we're in now, and so that self, is going to be the delegate for this controller. So any methods that we send to the delegate are just going to be sent to this main view controller. And you'll see in a minute why that's helpful. So now, instead of calling push view controller, we're calling this present modal view controller. And so this behavior is just a little different. So we didn't do that slide to the right thing. We did the flippy thing. And so the way we achieved that was just this different method. So just a different way of presenting a new view controller. So nothing fancy here, but you'll notice that we have this flip side view controller did finish. So as you remember, this is the method that's defined in the protocol for us. If you want to take a look at the protocol, we can just look up into the flip side view controller. And you'll see down here, this is where we're defining our protocol. So we're calling it flip side view controller delegate. And in order to use this protocol, you're going to need to implement a single method called flipsideViewController.didFinish. So in MainViewController, this is where we've implemented that method. And all we're doing is we're going to hide that ModalViewController. So before, we popped it off the stack. Now with ModalViewController, we're just going to dismiss them. So we're going to get rid of them and return to the view that created it. So any questions so far? OK, so now let's take a look at the flip side view controller in a little more detail.
So wait a second. I guess I'm wondering if all of this is written for us.
Yes, all this is written for you.
Why are we going to write such a button?
Well, I mean, it's written for you, but you probably want to understand what's going on in order to use it.
Use it how?
I mean, if you wanted to, in the future, use another modal view controller, you'd follow these same exact design patterns. So Xcode wouldn't generate that for you, but you'd need to write the code to use a new modal view controller yourself.
I guess personally, I'm just a little concerned about getting all this work done. So I'm sort of hoping we can go over stuff that's pertinent
to the actual solving. Yeah, so we're going to be going over the puzzle stuff next, actually. So just there's only one other thing that we need to worry about in here. And that's just the self-delegate. So instead of implementing this method ourselves, we're sending this message to the delegate, which you'll remember is just the main view controller. And so that's how we're achieving all of that behavior. And we're kind of mimicking the functionality of the start activity for result, because instead of dismissing the activity from that second activity, we're going to dismiss it from the first. And we can know when the second activity, or the second view controller now, has finished from the one that created it. So that's a walkthrough of the utility app. Are there any questions on that? OK, so let's take a look at this notion of equivalence classes. So remember last time we tried to Google break up a bitmap, and that didn't work out so well. So if you look at Wikipedia, we have this really handy definition of an equivalence class. So now that you know that, you know how to do the pset, and we can just go home. And you're probably thinking at this point, well, Apple implemented all this cool stuff for us, but there, alas, is no NS equivalence class. So what is an equivalence class? It sounds really fancy, but basically all they're doing is defining a group of words that share a letter at a given location. So remember, the equivalence class dash dash n is the group of all words, or the list of all words, that have an n at that position, so the n at the third letter. So in equivalence classes, order matters. So the group of words that end with n and the group of words that start with n are going to be different groups. And there can't be a word that is in both because n blank n is itself its own equivalence class. So when you're implementing this, don't forget that blank, blank, blank is also an equivalence class. So you want to consider all the words that do not have the letter the user pressed in. Otherwise, you want to consider where the letter is in the word that the user pressed in, that the user typed. Yep?
Are we also looking for blank NN, or is that covered by looking for the N in both positions?
So we're also looking for blank NN, so yes, so that's its separate equivalence class. If we go back here, I tried to list them all out. So yeah, so we see here that blank NN is going to be different, as is blank NNN. But we don't even have to worry about that because there are no words in the dictionary that are in that equivalence class. Yeah?
So initially we have to read through this whole plist and separate out into a data structure with only one letter, then two letters, then three, up to the longest word in the plist, right?
So initially, do we have to set this up in our data structure? So not really. So we'll go through how we're going to start partitioning things next. But we don't have to do everything right at the beginning. And we'll see why right now. So just quickly, how are we going to define? Oh, another question first?
I guess the general question pertaining to the approach that we should take here.
Mm-hmm.
We are writing an iPhone application, and an iPhone is kind of low on resources. And this task seems to be can get very resource intensive if we are dealing with a realistic amount, a realistic dictionary. So how much attention should we pay to optimizing the algorithms?
So yes, you're definitely right that the iOS is definitely a lot more memory strapped than, say, your laptop computer. So we're going to take a look at that as well, but you do want to pay attention to time and space consumption, particularly space consumption, because you have this massive plist, but there's a good chance that you don't need most of those words. And so we'll see really quickly how we can eliminate words that we don't need. But yes, so memory is a really important requirement for this pset. You don't want to be having 10 instances of your plist loaded in the iOS app at once. You try to want to minimize how much you have loaded at a given time. But we'll get to that as well. So just now there's the classes we might want to use when we're defining our equivalence classes, because that's still kind of an abstract term. But we can define them in terms of arrays, dictionaries, sets, whatever you feel most comfortable with. And so if we have a dictionary, that an instance of a dictionary could be, say, an equivalence class. So if we have a bunch of dictionaries, we can have all of the equivalence classes that we need to consider. So now that we say we have our equivalence classes, how do we know which one to use? So we need a way to map a word to its equivalence class. So that means that each equivalence class needs some unique identifier. So obviously we don't want to do this randomly because there'd be no way of that wouldn't be deterministic. There'd be no way of getting from a word to its identifier. So this identifier could be something like a number, it could be a string, basically anything that you can say, I have this word, and I want to know what equivalence class that it's in. So you're going to have not just one equivalence class, but some large collection of equivalence classes. So you need to know where to look in that collection of equivalence classes to get the class that you're concerned about with the word in question. So does that make sense, or are there questions there?
It seems like we will have separate collections of equivalent classes for each letter, given that we have a fixed number of letters in a word, like if the user already chose how many letters will be in the word.
Right, so it seems like we're going to have a fixed number of equivalence classes for each letter. So that's true, but let's say we're using, say, just a three-letter word, and the user never types in the letter Q. So we really don't need to worry about those equivalence classes, right?
So you're saying that we should only try and determine the equivalence classes once we know a letter that the user uses.
Right, so when should we try to determine the equivalence classes? You want to do so in such a way that's least wasteful. So if you find yourself, you know, I have all of these instances of equivalence classes and I have every possible combination, but suddenly my iPhone's out of memory and it crashes. So you definitely want to try to keep that in mind with managing your memory. You know, you don't want to have all this data you're not using. You want to limit yourself to only the data that's absolutely necessary to figure out what words to switch between. Yep?
Just back at the prior slide, you had dictionaries and mutable arrays and mutable sets. If it's mutable, does that imply that it's using more resources than, for example, just an NS array versus an NS mutable array?
So if it's mutable, does that imply it's using more resources? So that's not really much of a concern in the grand scheme of things because our plist is so huge. They're probably equivalent overhead. So don't worry about, you know, trying to create a mutable array into a regular array as soon as possible. That's not the type of overhead you're looking to reduce. More reducing the overhead of, I have 500,000 words loaded right now. Yep.
I'm a little bit confused about the equivalency classes. So for like a three-letter word, of course, you would have one equivalency where your initial letter doesn't belong to any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then you can use, then, you know, you have your given letter, you know, from left to right in the leftmost part or the middle one or the rightmost. So there's four equivalency classes. Then what happens if the letter can repeat?
So what happens if letters repeat in an equivalence class?
Yeah, like N-O-N.
Yeah, so those are going to be their own equivalence class. So if we flip back again, you'll see here that we actually have separate equivalent classes for repeating letters. So don't try to, you know, overlap, you know, have like the intersection of sets and blah, 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 blah. You can have your own equivalence class for, say, N blank N that's separate from N blank blank and blank blank N. So those will be different equivalence classes if with repeating letters.
Well, I guess, I mean, do we think out what the possibilities are without checking through what's in the plist? Is that what you're suggesting?
Do we think through the possibilities before we check in the plist?
Yes.
So you certainly could. I mean, you could, you know, permute all the letters, you know, all the possible ways. But that seems like it's not going to be the most space-efficient way of doing things. Right? So if we have all these permutations, but if the user is never going to type in those permutations, then we don't really need them. It's kind of a waste of space. Yeah?
So am I right in thinking then that the equivalence class is not the search, it's not the algorithm, it's just the thing that stores the set of matches?
Yes, so the equivalence class is a set. So you have a set of equivalence classes. Yeah. So equivalence class is actually a group of words, a collection of words that happens to be a set. Yep?
You need to form the equivalence class real time, or they're provided in the plist?
So do we have to form the excuse me? Do we have to form the equivalence class real time or load it in the plist? So you should be able to work with any plist. So if we hypothetically switched out words.plist for fruits.plist, your app should still work. Basically, that words.plist just defines your initial working set of words in the language. So you want to generate your equivalence classes from the plist. It won't be hard-coded into the plist itself. Yep?
This is a native app. We did not call the server or anything. So the plist size is 6.7 MB. So when I download my app on the phone, size is already in 6 or 7 MB. So is it like when the only thing that should come on the app is the class, or that the plist should also come in the iPhone app?
Oh, so when I say minimize size, I mean minimize RAM usage, not the size of the app. So if you wanted to have images or something, that wouldn't be using too much space, because if an image is just sitting on the iPhone, it's not consuming RAM. So we're more concerned about RAM, which is the number of resources that we've loaded into our app at a given time. So don't worry about the size of the plist file. That's totally fine for just sitting on your app. But what you don't want to do is load the plist file 10 times and have it sitting in your RAM. Yeah?
So do you have to, does it make sense to construct the plist after you have a first guess? Because, like in your example, you are creating lists after you know the guess is in it.
So is that smart? It might be. Is it smart to construct it after the first guess? Perhaps. That's the design decision that's up to you. This is kind of the way that I've gone about demonstrating it. So that might be the best decision, depending on your implementation.
Right. So then, once you create a set of equivalence classes, are they fixed? Or as the guesses keep coming, are we're shifting to new equivalence classes?
So once we've created equivalence classes, are they fixed? So fixed in the sense that a given equivalence class won't change, but not fixed in the sense that for every guess, we're going to be creating a new set of equivalence classes. So here, once the user has guessed n, and once we've fixed the location of this n, we're never looking at those equivalence classes ever again, right? Because, yes, we're never looking at these again, because we're now just working with these.
But are you now making maybe sub-equivalence classes? Because now you've gotten them in the
P. So are we now making sub-equivalence classes? So they're effectively new. They're effectively new equivalence classes, because they're at this point, they're based on a different dictionary. So you notice that these equivalence classes are based on that long dictionary, whereas these equivalence classes are only based on the three-word dictionary. So there, you don't have to worry about subclasses, but consider them effectively for each new step of the puzzle, you're creating new equivalence classes. Yep?
I think one of the things that's confusing, well, at least me, maybe mm-hmm. some other people, is to use the word class. This isn't a class in the object-oriented programming sense. We're not defining a .h file for these equivalence classes. They're just a returned set of values.
Yes, so an equivalence class is just the mathy term, this mathy term, actually, for just it's a set. So the class does kind of throw you off because we're doing object-oriented programming, but it's not a class. It doesn't have a .m and a .h file. It's a collection of words. Yep? So how do we know what the number of letters in the words is? That's something you configure in the settings. So when you flip to the flip side view controller, there's some sliders there. And one of the sliders is the word length. So you need to, when the user adjusts that, you need to act accordingly.
And regarding the word length, do you have to worry if the plus doesn't have any words of length 22? You know.
Oh, so if the plus does not have any words of a certain length?
Yeah.
You probably should worry about that possibility and just alert the user, there are no words of this length, you should switch another one. If that's not defined in the spec, then it's not officially required, but it is best to just, it's probably just that one case of 22 or similar numbers.
This is up to 7 months. Hmm? No, it's up to the longest word in your list.
Yeah.
What's the standard memory limit for an iPhone application?
So standard memory limit for an iPhone application. So depending on the model of your device, it has probably 256 megs or 512 megs, depending on what the device is. So we're not looking for like a ceiling RAM value. And you're not graded on, you use this percentage of RAM, so you get a check minus. We're just looking at, a conscious effort to reduce the amount of space that you're using. So don't get hung up on, I can save like one more byte of space here. We're really more concerned on
trying to make sure I don't get too many out of memory errors.
Right, exactly. So we're looking for a conscious effort to reduce the size of your memory usage and not have all this memory that you're never actually using. So that's our main concern there. Yeah?
And if the user goes into the flip side,
so if the user changes the size of the word, it would probably have to change the game unless you allow them to finish in the new game. If it's not defined in the spec, then it's there's certainly no required behavior there. It makes sense to me that if they change it, you would start a new game. But do look at the spec and try to implement what they do, and I'm sure there'll be a staff solution coming out soon, and then you can try to mimic the behavior of our staff solution. Yeah?
So do we have, if the equivalence class isn't the thing that's doing the searching, do we have like a regex or something like that that we would be using to search through the...
So the equivalence class is not doing the searching itself. The equivalence class is just where you're storing the data. And so you yourself need to determine, A, where the positions of the letter you're looking are at, and then B, what equivalence class that belongs to, and then you need to put it in the correct equivalence class. So that's something, the sorting into equivalence classes is something that you need to do.
Is that something you're going to go over?
Yes.
Good.
We will go over as much as possible. Okay, so let's move on. So just remember that we need to create an identifier for our equivalence class. So if we have some number of equivalence classes, we need to know where in this collection of classes, equivalence classes that we need to be adding to. So when we're implementing this, we need to make sure that when we're sorting things into equivalence classes, that we can still easily get the largest equivalence class. So you know, as you're going through all this, you know, don't lose sight of the original goal, which is simply to figure out what the best one is to choose. So once we have all of our equivalence classes loaded, you need some way of going through all of the equivalence classes, finding the largest one, and then saying, OK, this is my new working set of words. So once you know the largest class, you need to make sure that from that equivalence class, you can get all of the words that are in that equivalence class, and then figure out what letters should be displayed on the screen. So what positions of letters that you're committing to. So those are the two things you need to do after you decide in your equivalence class. So just when you're designing everything, you need to make sure that these two things are simple to do with your design. So now just a couple words on the time and space consumption. So these are, again, these are not the end-all goals of your program. You know, optimization is not, this is not a how optimized can you make this, but we do need to keep these things into consideration. So first, let's consider time. So we want to try to make this as fast as possible. The user shouldn't have to wait 20 seconds for for Hangman to tell you that, oh, there is an N at that position, because that's really suspicious, and the user's going to figure out that it's just cheating. So just some basic data structures. So if we have an array or a dictionary, and we're just looking up a key, so we're saying, get me the third element of this array, get me the key for some word, that's fast. Iterating through an entire collection is not so fast. So if you have a huge array and you want to find something in that array, so you iterate through it, that's going to be slow. But if you're just looking something up, that's going to be a lot faster. Similarly, we don't want to be considering words that we know are wrong. So while in our design, we need to consider a way of throwing out words or saying, OK, this word has an N as the last letter, and I have 200,000 words that don't have N as the last letter. I do not want to be looking at those and sorting them into their appropriate equivalence classes, because that's a waste of time and a waste of space. So remember that words.plist is pretty big, and we probably don't need to keep all of those words in RAM. In fact, we don't need to keep all those words in RAM for the duration of the program. So we do want to try to keep our data structures as small as possible. Now, when I say that, I mean we could feasibly have this massive array. But if all of the elements in this array are empty, right? If it's a really sparse array but it's huge, that's a lot of wasted space. So if we have an array that's different than, say, a linked list, where the size of the linked list is exactly the number of elements in it, when you have an array with empty elements, you're effectively wasting space. And so that's not going to be the best use of space. And you're also going to want to remove anything that you no longer need as soon as you possibly can. But again, these are not your end goals. You know, you're not gonna. This is not an assignment on how fast and least space consumption can you make it. This is just something that the design portion you're gonna need to take into consideration. Yeah.
When you say lookup versus iterate, and I understand the concept of iterating over a dictionary or an array or whatever. Are there specific functions in the iOS SDK who are doing what you're calling a lookup versus iterating?
Sure. So if we're dealing with an array, then the function for getting an index out of that array is just going to be object at index. And you're just going to specify at an index, and it's just going to jump to that index and grab it. Similarly, in a dictionary, you can use the value for key method, and you're going to give it a key, and then you get the associated value. A couple of sections ago, I had a list of useful, handy collection functions. So those were defined there. But yeah, so you could feasibly iterate through the whole thing. An array is straightforward. A dictionary, you have that all keys method, and that's going to return an array of all the keys, and you can feasibly iterate through all of those. But if you just look at the methods that basically take a position in the collection, that's going to be fast lookup.
But you're saying that
What's that?
I mean, you're saying, say I want to go to this position in the array, or I want to go to this key in the array. How do you know that in advance, I guess, is my point.
So how do you know that in advance? So this is what I mean when I'm talking about these unique identifiers. So if we say, I have this word, and I can hash it, we're not effectively hashing it, but we can get some identifier or something, then we know exactly where to look. So instead of looking through this huge array, we can know exactly where to look if we have an identifier for the class.
But at some point, we need to read in that data file and presumably iterate through it so we know what's in it, right?
Yes, so we do have to actually physically iterate through everything to determine the equivalence class. You want to get all the words that are in your working set, and you want to iterate through all the words, and then you're actually going to need to iterate through the characters in the words to figure out to what equivalence class that word belongs.
So, like for each game at the beginning of the game, we would need presumably to go through that huge list once, identify the biggest subset of them first, and then work from there. Is that sort of the idea?
There are many ways to do this. But basically, once you load in your plist file, you can do some initial cleanup if you want. But then, when the user starts typing in values, that's when you're really going to start to filter that huge plist into this much smaller working set of words. So at that point, iterating through your working set of words is going to be really fast, because really quickly you're going to go from 200,000 to like 1,000 or so. And that should happen really fast just based on things like the first letter and the word length is going to eliminate a huge percentage of the words. So that seems like it's an expensive process, but the way to make that faster is to reduce the amount of unnecessary work you're doing while you're iterating through the words and the characters.
I think the question is, there's no escaping the first iteration.
Oh, so is that question, there's no escaping the first iteration? Right. So there, you do at some point have to load the whole plist. But that's not really a lag issue, because that's the equivalent of like a loading screen. So that won't really, the user's not going to figure out that we're cheating, because they haven't entered anything yet. So from a user experience perspective, that's not too bad. But we do at some point need to create this initial working set of words. So eventually we're going to filter that huge working set down, but it does need to be created at the beginning at some point. Yes. So it's actually a lot more straightforward than it sounds. So we're going to look at how we can get this plist into an array. And then iterating through that array, we have NS string elements. And we can iterate through an NS string just like it were an array of characters. And we can get every character at every position. And then from there, it's up to you to determine the equivalence class.
Can we preload the list of words into a database?
For this pset, no. We're going to ask that we load from the plist and whatever that words.plist file contains. So in the real world, that would probably be faster, loading it into some database and we could do some cool queries and stuff. But for this pset, we're going to pretend like iOS doesn't have databases and that all they have is plists. Yep?
What if the player just say, facetiously, just stay with playing a whole other word? So wouldn't you want to just keep that sort of your initial overhead of getting just a subset of words that only have four letters in it?
Yes, so if the user is staying with a four-letter word, you're correct. It would be a wasteful amount of time to go through that initial plist and parse it all again. So whenever the user changes the working set of words, that's when you need to update your working set. So that could be by saying, I want a new game with a seven-letter word, or by entering in an A, which is also going to change the working set of words. So yes, so the little small things like that are definitely what we're looking for. And recognizing that we don't need to parse the plist file every single time if the user hasn't changed much. Okay. So now, just some quick tips and tricks. So this is something that's not immediately obvious on an iPhone, but when we type in a text field, well, we get this nice keyboard. But how do we get that keyboard without a text field? Because we don't really want to be typing into a text field with our hangman. We just want a keyboard, and the user can just press a letter, and then it shows up or not. That's a much better experience than having this like little tiny text field we can type in a letter, because that's kind of lame. So if we remember this concept of a first responder, So this is going to be the UI view that currently has focus. So once you're a first, you could any UI view can do two things. It can become the first responder, or if it is the first responder, it can no longer be the first responder. So if we make a text field first responder, we're going to pull up a keyboard. If we say, OK, that text field is no longer the first responder, the user is no longer interacting with that text field, the keyboard's going to go away. And we can also leverage this property of UI view called hidden. And this is a Boolean property, either yes or no. If it's yes, then the property is not displayed by the displayed on the screen. And if it's yes, if it's no, then it is. So using this, we can do. Oh, I quit Xcode. That's sad. So here, if we look at our UI, we can do something really cool here. So we have this this text view, and we're going to have switches that can control whether the keyboard is displayed or whether that text field is displayed. So really simply, the way to do that is just to control the first responder status of that text field. So when the user taps the text field, it becomes the first responder. The keyboard gets pulled up, and the user's interacting with that text field. But if we just tell that text field to become the first responder, we send a focus to it, and we basically force the user to be interacting with that text field. And so because the user is now interacting with it, the keyboard pops up. However, if we then hide that text field, the user doesn't know they're interacting with a text field, and all they see is a keyboard. So if we run this, we could leverage this cool little trick that whenever a text field is a first responder, we're going to pull up the keyboard. So here, if I hide the keyboard, you'll notice that what I've just done is I've sent the resign first responder message to this text field. So now, text field's gone. And if I send the become first responder, keyboard's back up even though the user doesn't see a text field. Cool.
When you actually input anything into the keyboard, does that input get put into that text field? Does that save somewhere in that?
Yes. So does this actually get input into the text field? Yes, it does. And we can get at that value via the textField.text property, and all of those event handlers are still going to fire. The user just won't see anything. But if you actually hide it and you start typing, like something, we can actually see it's actually starting to autocorrect for us. So it is actually being entered into the text field. We just can't see it.
And you can turn autocorrect off, right?
Yes. Yes, so that's just a property of the text field. We can turn that off so that doesn't happen to us.
One further question. I'm assuming there would be some kind of a button to like start a new game, which would then display the keyboard, right?
Yes, so if we want a new button to start a new game, then that's probably where we're going to send this become first responder, which will show the keyboard effectively.
And how do we make the text field stop accepting input after the first character?
Say that again? How do we make it stop accepting input?
Well, we only want one character.
So this is kind of another way of another challenge of the PSET, but if we just have our text field or however it is we're accepting input, if we are using a text field, then we can use substrings to basically get the character that we want. Or we can also look at the UI text field delegate, and that has some methods controlling whether or not the user can stop interacting with it or anything like that. But just as we can get this property text, we can also set the property text. So if we set that to the empty string, we've effectively cleared the text field, and the next time the user interacts with it, it'll be empty. So there's several ways you can do that, one of which is just to take substrings. So given an NS string or an NS mutable string, we can get substrings really simply with substring to index. So that's going to say I'm going to start at the beginning of the string, and I'm going to take a substring until this location, or substring from index, which says I'm going to start at this given index in the string, and I'm going to take the substring until the end of the string. If you don't want this one-sided boundary, but you want to define two points in the string from which to get a substring, you can use the substring with range. That's going to take an NS range, and that's just going to say what position do I want to start at and what position do I want to end at. So that's pretty straightforward.
So time I click through the option click on it, I get something that's called getting started. I don't get the documentation itself, the definition of what methods are available.
So if you're not getting documentation, you might have to install it. So that's going to be under preferences. And then here we have this documentation tab. And this is where we have a list of libraries that we have documentation for. So if this get button is next to any of them, that means you have not installed it. So you might need to click check it install now, and then there'll be some get buttons. And if you click those, they should download, and you'll be able to get the documentation. Even if you... So all of that would be the iOS 4.3 library. You can also just pull up the organizer. So up in the top left corner here, if we click on that, we go to this documentation tab. And in this search bar, we can just type in something like NS string. We hit enter. And then we can actually just pull up the entire reference for the NS string. And so this is where we can see all those methods I just described. So getting C string, strings length. And then here's the substring methods that I just mentioned. So to do that, we can just enter in this little search bar, and then we can get documentation for whatever we want. And also, at just developer.apple.com, it's going to be the same thing as at developer.android.com. And all of this is also hosted there.
I'm still not really clear on what methods are available for searching the strings that we get out of the plist array.
So to search something that we get out of the plist array, we can simply iterate over the characters of the string.
Okay, and that would be the preferable way rather than using a regex sort of situation.
Yeah, so because it's Objective-C, you might be able to pull in like a regex library, or maybe there's someone built in, but it's certainly fine to just iterate through things. That might even be easier because you almost don't know what you're searching for. But you could certainly do it with a regex. If you prefer to do that, go for it. But searching through every character of the string to locate where all the characters are is certainly fine. So to do that, we can use this fast enumeration that we've been looking at, this for ID in something. We can just apply that to an NS string, and we're going to iterate through the characters of it. So nothing fancy. We can just treat the string as if it were an array, and we can iterate through the characters of it. Because in C, strings are simply arrays of characters. So same thing. We can iterate through the string as if it were an array, and then we can get all of that. So I believe that that's what it is. If that's not true and I just lied to you, then what will certainly work is iterating it using this character at index. So if we just have some iterator variable, I, and we iterate I from 0 to the length of the string, then we can call character at index, and we're going to get every individual character. So, but I may have lied to you about the fast enumeration. I'm drawing a blank now. But this will definitely work, this character at index. So we just call that character at index for every possible index in the string. And so that'll effectively iterate through it. Yep?
I have a question. For example, for some of the app, when you open it, there's this thing called loading. During that time, can I have something for this app which is loading, and then on the background, it will basically just read and list and put the length of each character?
Sure. So if you wanted to implement like a splash screen or something, you certainly could. You're by no means required by the spec, but you certainly could do that. All we're looking for is for you to basically parse the plist as soon as you need to, and then work with that data. So you could use a splash screen. You're certainly not required to by the spec. Other questions? So with a few minutes left, just one other quick thing you might find yourself wanting to do. So if you've worked with C a lot and you're sick of seeing these NS strings and you really just want an array of characters, we could use this method cString using encoding, and then we just need to specify we want ASCII. And so from that, we can get an array of characters out of an NS string. And there we can treat that just like an array, and every element of the array is going to be a character. So with these characters, C treats them as if they were their ASCII values. So lowercase a has an ASCII value that is lower than that of the character b. So we can do comparisons on these characters as if they were numbers. So a is less than b is going to return true because the ASCII value for a is lower than that for b. And we could look those up at ASCIITable.com. That might be handy for your creating an identifier for your equivalence classes. It might not, depending on how you want to implement them. But just know that if you're looking to convert a character into a number, if you ever want to do that, really simply, you can just convert it to the char data type. And then you can work with that as if it were a number. So if I said a plus 1, I'm going to get back a b with these chars. So that's just something C does, nothing special with Objective-C, but something you might find in handy. So a couple more methods. You'll notice that all the words in the plist are in all caps. So if you want to either lowercase all those words, or you want to uppercase something that you're sending in, we can use the method lowercase string or capitalize string, respectively, to throw everything to lowercase or throw everything to uppercase. So finally, when we looked at plists in section, we saw that we could load it into an NS dictionary with this init with contents of file. And then you could specify the file with your NS bundle. And you can also do that with NS arrays. So because our plist, everything is listed in the value column, if we just load it into an array with this init with contents of file, then we're going to have an array of all the words. So that's really simple. You don't actually have to, you know, iterate through every cell of the plist or something. If we just call this init with contents of file, we've now loaded the entire plist into an array in memory. Just remember that this operation is probably pretty slow, so you don't want to be doing this all over the place if we don't need to. So finally, one more thing we have to implement in the pset is this notion of shared preferences. Or not shared preferences, but what was shared preferences in Android. So saving user defaults. So just like we save the state of nPuzzle, we also want to be saving state for our evil hangman game. So the way we're going to do that in Objective-C is with this NS user defaults. And just like shared preferences, they're super easy to use. So to get the user defaults associated with your app, we can just send the message standard user defaults. And we're going to get back this dictionary, effectively, that we can use to save preferences to the disk. So we have this set object for key. So just like in a dictionary, we're going to have some object to write to our preferences. We're going to give it a key because we're storing key value pairs. To get the value, we're going to say object for key. And if we want to remove something for the preferences, we can say remove object for key. So just to take a look at an example of saving defaults. So here, we're going to just load our what we've saved in our defaults when the app starts up. So we're just going to create a new NS user defaults object. We're just going to get it with the standard user defaults. And then really simply, we're going to read two values. The first is a string, so I'm going to say object for key. And the second is a Boolean, so I have this bool for key. And so we have these convenience methods. So if we don't want to worry about casting things all over the place, in addition to object for key, we have bool for key, array for key, dictionary for key, all that fun stuff. Listed on the previous slide, but in the interest of time, in order to save the state, again, really, really simple, we just say NS user defaults, standard user defaults, now we can set some Boolean. We're going to give it a key of switch, and we're going to give it a value of the property on of our switch, which is just a Boolean, or if we're saving an NS string, same thing, we're just going to set an object, because NS string is an object, it's not a primitive type, and we're going to give it a key of text. And so just like that, we can save key value pairs in our app really, really simply. So any last questions before we finish up? So how do we load those back afterwards? Right up here, we can read from those user defaults with this object for key instead of that set value for key or set object. So in this example app, we're basically just restoring the state when it loads, so we're looking in our defaults and we're getting these values. If this doesn't exist, so if we haven't defined a key text, this is just going to return nil. We don't have this notion of returning some sentinel value, it's just going to return nil. So you probably want to check for that. And then to save them, we can just write it as if we're a dictionary. So any other questions? So feel free to post on help.cs76.net with any questions you may have, and good luck starting Evil Hangman.